Arizona's news station, KTAR News 92.3 FM. Arizona Votes, Primary Day 2022, with Mike Broomhead.
Appreciate you being here. Looking at the statewide races, we are still seeing what's happening, a little bit less than 2% separating Kerry Lake and Karen Taylor Robeson. We had a conversation with Chuck Coughlin earlier. And Chuck Coughlin is with High Ground. He's a political analyst, and he's also known for a consultant and just knows the industry very, very well. I talked with him about how many votes are left. This is an interesting, this is what's left. This is what's out there still to count since this race is so close.
So Stephen Richards estimating there's probably 125,000 of those people who dropped their ballots off at Maricopa County on Election Day. There's probably, Mike, 20,000 that arrived in the mail at the post office, postage, received about 20,000 of those in Maricopa County. So there's probably about 145,000 ballots out in Maricopa County, roughly. If you percentage that out, Maricopa County is 65% of the voting population. You know, the rest of the state is the balance. And then you take that percentage and bang it off that 145 figure. You got probably another 45 to 50,000 ballots that are out statewide, with about 27,000 of those coming from Pima County, and about the remainder, 24,000 or so, coming from Greater Arizona.
So that's kind of where it stands. That's what's left. So in the conversation about how this all plays out, early voters, people that mailed their ballots in, that's what was counted first when the original drop came out in Maricopa County and around the state. And that's what gave Karen Taylor Robeson an early lead. It was a 9-point or a 10-point lead at one point. And it was the early voters that mailed their ballots in well ahead of time. And then as the night went on, Maricopa County and others, when they had the voting machine and the tabulators, they downloaded the data from them and they posted those. Kerry Lake on Election Day chipped away at that lead, and she now holds about a little less than 2% lead over Karen Taylor Robeson. So the question is now, which way does this go? How does it fall? So it's so weird. They call them early voters, and now they call them late earlies. Late earlies are the people that drop their ballot off on Election Day or mail them in right before the deadline. So if they vote the way the early voters did, it could go the way of Robeson, and she could cut into this lead. If the late earlies vote the way that people did on Election Day, then it could increase the lead for Kerry Lake. That's where we stand. And that's kind of the inside baseball, how the sausage is made, what people are looking at. But with what's left, there have been already 1.1 million ballots that have been cast. 97% of the precincts are reporting. So now let's, you take a look at this race and how it plays out. The reason why I think this is so important, and we do get wrapped up in candidates, and that to me is a mistake in this sense. We do this with sports, where we have a favorite team and we live and die with our favorite team. And when our team doesn't win, we're angry. But when it comes to something like this, you have to start being a bit more pragmatic, in my opinion. And you have to vote for people that you believe are more like you and will do more likely do what you would want them to do in office. And the reason why I say that is because these primaries were tough. If you look at how the primary went between Jim Lehman and Blake Masters, but it also go down ticket. There's a lot of other people involved in that race. It got contentious. I moderated a few of these debates. I moderated a gubernatorial debate. I moderated a debate with attorney general candidates. And it got contentious. I mean, there was some fisticuffs going on, so to speak. They were very contentious. But how does an Abe Hamadeh now get the support of a Rodney Glassman? Not just the individual, but genuine support from the voters. That's one of the things they have to wrestle with moving forward. The other is, how do they get the independent voters? The independent voters in Maricopa County outnumber everybody else. They don't statewide, but they do in Maricopa County. How do you speak to independent voters and get them to believe that you are the best candidate in any one of these statewide races? That's what the focus is going to be. So there is some advantages. Mark Kelly has an advantage. A, he's the incumbent. And B, Mark Kelly is running unopposed. So he's been able to message while to everybody while the Republicans are duking it out amongst themselves. and focusing on Republicans. And that's a that, you know, that's not an, I wouldn't say an unfair advantage. It's just an advantage. And same thing, you know, Katie Hobbs had almost no primary. And I mean that with all due respect to Marco Lopez. He was never polling very high, although I thought he was a brilliant guy. He would never poll very high. She didn't really have to go out and fight in a primary. She's going to have to now come out of her shell, and she's going to have to fight whoever she faces in this election. And it is going to be an uphill battle for her as well, because you, there's no way in a race like that that you're not going to be able to debate, that you're not going to be able to, you're not going to be able to sit back. You're going to have to be out there. Those messages are going to matter. And every voter in Arizona, the way we all should feel about these races, in my opinion, is that the direction of the state is hanging in the balance. Who will be our chief executive? I mean, that's really what we're talking about, a chief executive. Who is it that will run the state as a chief executive that is now going to have to work with the legislature? And that's the other thing we haven't even discussed yet. What is our state legislature going to look like? Going into this race, we have watched over the last dozen years, we have watched the decline of the Republican lead in the state legislature, in the House and the Senate. In this last session of the legislature, I think it was a one-seat majority in both the House and the Senate. And so there was a lot of working together that happened between the two parties, because there's also fractioning of the parties, or factions of the party inside, where sometimes Republicans aren't supporting Republicans and you got to hope that you've got support of Democrats and vice versa. Are we going to see a shift in the state legislature? And we can't, I'll be honest with you, we cannot overlook that. The state legislature could flip, and it could be for the first time since I've been in Arizona, and I don't know when the last time it happened, that the state legislature could be controlled by Democrats. That's a real possibility. As we move into this general election, these same candidates that are winning primaries in small legislative districts, are they going to be able to win races? Are they going to be able to defeat Democrat opponents? Democrats latched onto, and this is not a negative, I'm saying this is just an observation. Democrats latched on to something with Senator Sinema. Democrats realized that Democrats are going to vote for Democrats largely. Republicans are the same way. They scream and shout, I'm a Republican, and I know there's a big battle that goes on within the Republican Party, and that word rhino gets thrown around, and I'm not voting for rhinos. But when you're faced in your little district of voting for someone that is so far away from what you believe, and someone that you are aligned with most of the time, generally speaking, even Republicans vote for Republicans. That's the way it goes. Senator Sinema figured out independent voters are going to make the biggest difference. And she ran a campaign. She said right here on KTAR, she said she was a Democrat, small D, people don't care about parties. I'm independent just like Arizona. And she was immensely successful. And you're going to see a lot of Democrats follow suit, because that's the way to win. And I'm anxious to see how it works out. I'm anxious to see if that strategy works for them. Coming up in a moment, we go back to crime and punishment. It's something we've been talking about almost every day on the show. And I think a lack of punishment for crimes is worse right now than it's ever been in many places. And we should not follow suit. So we'll talk about elections, and we'll also talk about this coming up in just a moment.
Values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
Hey, thanks for being here. A lot of changes happening in Arizona. We are going to have we're going to have a new county attorney. We will, because the interim county attorney looks like she won that primary, and she's going to have to run in a general election against a woman named Julie Gunnigal. And Rachel Mitchell will run for that office. She is the interim county attorney. But again, the direction of the county attorney's office could dramatically change. The willingness to prosecute cases, how you prioritize cases, how you prioritize the office, that could change dramatically. That also, we are going to have a new police chief in the city of Phoenix. An interim police chief has been named, and he's coming from Baltimore. He'll be here in early September. But he will just be overseeing the agency while it is going through the process of a DOJ investigation. But I don't believe that he's even going to be in the running for the permanent position. There will be a nationwide search, which means the direction of the police department could go in a different way. So policy isn't just limited to political candidates or political offices. The policies of whoever you have. And again, whether you're hiring or you are electing a chief executive, whether it's a governor or someone that's going to run your company, somebody that you're going to put in charge of things, you want to choose wisely because their ideology and their plans, their policy is going to dictate the way that organization goes. I bring all of that up because of the crime and punishment stuff we talk about very often, and I believe they go hand in hand. If you look no further than where San Francisco was and where LA County is right now, same guy. Same guy. George Gascon was the police chief in the city of Mesa in Arizona. He went into California, was the county attorney or the DA up in San Francisco. Disaster in the minds because of the increase in crime and the attitude and policy toward punishment. You've got L.A. law enforcement, whether it's the county sheriff's office or the different departments within L.A. County, and they are outraged at the lack of enforcement. And the easy on crime policies that are leading to where we are. So to connect this to Arizona, I told this story earlier. There's a 19-year-old kid who on Monday, and I call him a kid, he's a man, but a 19-year-old kid went to Chandler Fashion Square, bought a hat at the mall, and got into an argument in the parking lot because he tried to rob somebody with an AR-15 rifle. And the guy refused to give up his items, and this guy starts popping off rounds, about 30 rounds in the parking lot. And then the criminal genius that this kid is goes back to the exact same mall the next day wearing the hat he bought the day before. People called the cops. They went and arrested him. He was unarmed when they arrested him, but he had 30 fentanyl pills on him. They arrested him on a bunch of charges, one of them being a prohibited possessor. He is someone that isn't supposed to have a firearm in the first place. So, leading me to my point, you are either going to focus on the guns, which is, in my estimation, a disaster because you are disarming law-abiding citizens and making them less safe. Having this conversation with somebody online right now asked me, would I give up my AR-15 if it would save one life? I said no. And I asked back, would you leave the laws the way they are if I could save one life when they are 15? Nope, because you can use a different gun. No, no, you can't. Because the criminals will still have the AR-15s. They will always have them. All those years where the shootings were supposedly going down during the Clinton administration, did you ever see a bust on television, a drug bust especially, back in the cocaine heyday? You know, in the 80s when the cartels were stopped bringing in marijuana in large amounts and they started bringing in cocaine and the cocaine cowboys and all that was going on. I was living in South Florida. I remember that like it was yesterday. And then we had the assault weapons ban. Remember how that was going to save lives? Did you ever see a bust of a drug dealer during that time period that didn't involve an AR-15 type rifle? An assault rifle. The answer is no, you didn't. The criminals will always have those guns. If you limit them or you cut off access to them, what you're doing is limiting my ability to protect myself because I'm going to abide by the law. I'm a law-abiding citizen. The criminals, this same 19-year-old kid that was prevented by law from having any gun, still had one. So more laws limits me. Not this maniac. The only way you limit them is with punishments that they understand are so severe that it is not worth doing. That's the only way. Now, you still aren't talking about, we haven't confronted mental illness. We haven't confronted any of that. But as far as the people out there that have shown a propensity to violence, unless they know that they are going to serve a serious amount of prison time just for having a gun, not a slap on the wrist, not a suspended sentence, not some jail time and a suspended sentence. And if you live out your probation, then we'll take it. Nope. You are found with a gun and you're a prohibited possessor. We are going to lock you up. We are going to lock you up for a very long time. which means either A, you've learned your lesson, or B, it doesn't matter because you're locked up. And unless we do something like that, this problem never gets close to being solved. You can fight, and I will fight this to the death because I know, I know it. The example here in Arizona I've used. Over 10 years ago, we relaxed our firearms laws in Arizona. We made it so that if you legally own a handgun in Arizona, a firearm, you can conceal it without a permit. Now, I have a CCW. I have a concealed carry permit. But I don't have to. I can carry my firearm concealed anytime I want to. And there were people, oh my gosh, you have to have training, and this is going to be terrible, and No, it wasn't. You know why? Because law-abiding citizens aren't dangerous. Whether they have a gun in their pocket, they have it on their hip, or they have it in their car. We are focused on the wrong people. I want this solved like everybody else does. The accusation that I love my guns more than I love safety or human life is just a distraction and completely and utterly false. You are going to weaken the good people, and you are going to keep the bad people strong. That's what these laws will do, period. Coming up in a moment, we're going to talk about sanctuary cities, but we're also going to talk about something we have been warning about at the border that is unfortunately coming very, very true. Both of those next.
Mike Broomhead Show, KTAR News, 92.3 FM, and the KTAR News app.
Hey, thanks for being here. So the number of illegals rescued by Border Patrol soars to record highs as the Biden administration declares the border is secure. That's the headline from the Daily Caller. Migrant deaths and rescues at the U.S.-Mexico border have reached another high. There were 18,881 illegal alien rescues and 650 illegal alien deaths between October of 2021 and July of this year, according to the data. In 18,881 rescues. So there's two directions to go with this part of the conversation. Number one is the idea of heartless people on the border that are not helping. That is not true. I will tell you, from the people that live in border towns to the ranchers that have property on the border to the people that are hired in federal service, whether it's ICE agents or CBP agents, they are first responders. And they have become first responders. I've told the story that when I learned this lesson years ago, going down to the border and meeting with ranchers and just, you know, getting a picture of what our border looked like, secure and unsecure portions of it, and listening to ranchers tell stories about how they ride their land. First of all, they live in prisons. You think about being a rancher. And as a rancher, you think one of the advantages, because there aren't that many, it's a rough life. But if you own a ranch, it's wide open spaces, it's relative safety, sleep with your windows open. They put bars on their windows and doors. They are terrified because when people come into the country illegally and they find a piece of property, usually they're starving. They have no water. They are on the verge of death. And this is a place of respite. If they're not home, the home gets broken into. Their refrigerators get ransacked. I mean, there's a lot of things that happen because of the desperation of the people that are brought here. Number one. The other thing, as I learned about ranchers, is when they ride their land, usually on ATVs, not horseback much anymore, but when they're repairing fences and they're riding their property, they travel with a rifle and they travel with a first aid kit and water, because they find people in desperate situations because the cartels don't give a damn about people. They will leave you to die in the desert. Yuma. The people of Yuma were overwhelmed with people recently, and what did they do? How did the people of Yuma respond? Their 911 system was being overwhelmed. All of these organizations were being overwhelmed, and yet the people of Yuma saw the human need, and they brought blankets and water that were stolen by the cartels because there was no federal presence. So the very same cartel people that brought these people to the border, they were given supplies by the good people of Yuma County to survive along the fence line until the federal agents could get there to process them. Those items were stolen by armed members of the cartels. It's all true stories. So the first angle in this story for me is the benevolence of the good people in Border Patrol and in ICE. And when they are, what they do is they save lives. They are first responders. And then secondly, for everyone out there that bought into the narrative that we were going to have a more humane treatment of people, how do you defend it? If you are still trying to defend this, and if the way you're going to defend it is talk about how horrible it was before, you have at the very minimum not changed a thing. As a matter of fact, there is not a resource on the planet that says it isn't worse right now than it's ever been. The border crossing at the southern United States from Mexico into the U.S. has been deemed the most dangerous land crossing on the planet. I want you to think of the third world countries. I want you to think about this. The border between Syria and Iraq at one time was controlled almost completely by ISIS, and how horrible that terrorist organization is. So what would that border crossing be like in your mind between Iraq and Syria? They just named recently the U.S. border, the U.S. southern border, is the most dangerous land crossing on the planet. No policy change, no demand for a policy change. I can demand it all day long. And that's where, that's the sad truth of this, is that people like me, in talk radio, Republican, conservative, I'm just an echo chamber, right, to them. Of course I'm going to say that. They're never going to win me over. That my voice doesn't count. They're never going to get my vote. That Joe Biden is never getting my vote for anything. So he doesn't care what I think, nor should he. But he cares what a lot of independent voters think, and he cares what a lot of Democrats think. And if you're a results-oriented person and you have an expectation of success from your side of the aisle because you believe in the ideology, but the ideology and the policies aren't working, and if you look at the numbers, privately it's happening. There are more and more Democrats every single day, and there's a majority of them now, especially younger Democrats, that are saying Joe Biden should not run for re-election. And it certainly isn't because they don't like him. Joe Biden's been an elected Democrat for how many decades in this country in both the Senate, then he was the Vice President of the United States. He has been an immensely popular person in that party. But unless people start making demands, and I mean this very sincerely, unless Republicans start demanding results of Republicans and Democrats demanding results of Democrats, nothing changes. I wish if I were, and I'm never going to run for, I should say never say never, but I'm not running for office for anything, for anything. But if I were running for office, I would spend most of my time and most of my money speaking to people that don't vote. I would go and talk to the people out there that have strong opinions and strong beliefs, but don't come become a part of the process because they don't believe the process either works or that they can change anything. Because those people, those like-minded people on both sides of the aisle that don't like the direction of the country and they don't engage because it's a dirty business, if those people engaged, they could change things in one election cycle. The entire House of Representatives and a third of the Senate and a president every 2 years, you know, every 4 years, but every other cycle. We're in a midterm now. And they just don't do it. But that'd be the group I'd talk to. I would try to get them to change their minds. In a moment, we're going to talk foreign policy because we've got a lot of war of the words that are going on out there. We got Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, and then we've also got the issue that happened in Afghanistan. We're going to talk about those two things very quickly in just a couple of moments.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show, KTAR News, 92.3 FM, and the KTAR News app.
Hey, I'm going to hope you join me in helping out in our community. We're putting together community service projects with something called Broomhead's Action Alliance. We've been doing it for a while with a lot of success, and it's so much fun and a way to serve in the community. If you just want to know when we're doing it and sign up to be on the list, you're not committing to doing anything but getting the list, just text ACTION to 411-923. We'll even send you a free t-shirt. That's ACTION to 411-923. All right, so let's talk about a couple of different topics rolled into one, and that's foreign policy is the overall topic. But we know that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, made a trip to Taiwan, and I made this statement yesterday. I don't agree with anything about Nancy Pelosi's politics, and I never have. I don't like her as Speaker of the House. I don't like the way she behaves. I don't like the way she does business, and I don't like her policies. I don't like any of it. Never have, never will. And I'll be glad when she is done as Speaker of the House and done in Congress. Let's lay the groundwork there. But when a foreign leader, like they did in China, threatens to shoot down a plane of the American Speaker of the House, I don't care what party you're in, as an American, I'm outraged. And I think the American public needs to stand up and say, you're not going to push us around. Because ultimately, they don't know much about our politics. Their leadership might, but their citizens really don't. Just like we don't know a whole lot about theirs. But when it becomes us against them, we have to defend us. So in that regard, I was outraged. But the foreign policy, and you wonder why. Why does China believe that they can get away with making a statement like you're going to get shot down over Taiwan? That's a legitimate place to start the questioning. Secondly, about Afghanistan. There was a conversation that happened about Afghanistan because the Al-Qaeda leader, al-Zawahiri, was shot and killed in a drone strike in Afghanistan, where he had been hiding out for months. So I want you to hear a little bit of back and forth between Peter Doocy and John Kirby as they're talking about what happened and why it's important.
Something you just said is not consistent with what we were told last year. You're saying that you've always known there was a small number of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. President Biden said, what interest do we have in Afghanistan at this point with Al-Qaeda gone?
Yeah, I mean, in a major way, Al-Qaeda was not playing a... No, wait, let me finish. They weren't playing a major role in operations or resourcing or planning in Afghanistan. But, Peter, I know specifically because I was at a different podium a year ago, and we talked about the fact that Al-Qaeda had a presence in Afghanistan, but small and not incredibly powerful or potent. And I think, again, without getting into numbers, we would still assess that to be the case.
He followed up by saying to John Kirby, so we know that the Taliban was harboring the world's most wanted terrorist. You guys gave a whole country to a bunch of people who are on the FBI's most wanted list. What did you think was going to happen? And the response was, I take issue with the premise that we gave a whole country to a terrorist group. You did. Not only do we give the country to a terrorist group, to all of my friends out there, I will continue to beat this drum. And I know what's frustrating for you, but we are talking in this country, and there is a bill that passed in our House of Representatives that was a ban on assault rifles. I don't like that term, but that's your term. They are going to ban Americans, if they can, from purchasing more AR-15 type rifles. We left thousands, up to 50 caliber and automatic weapons in Afghanistan when the Taliban took over. If you don't see the absurdity in that statement and the danger you put the Afghan people in and the danger you put the people in the region in and the rest of the world, you're not paying attention. Foreign policy, I have stated before, we should not be the world's police force, but we also shouldn't sit back and watch what's happened. Everybody in this country seems to be so focused on the rights of people that have been put upon, whether it's whether you're gay or straight or you're trans or you're women. How do you think those communities are faring in Afghanistan since we left? How do you think they're faring in Afghanistan since we left? We left thousands upon thousands of automatic firearms in Afghanistan. Now the most wanted terrorist leader in the world was found living undercover in Kabul for months before he was taken out by a CIA drone. Foreign policy matters too. Our reputation in the world and whether or not the world respects us or fears us matters. And you've got the Chinese threatening the Speaker of the House to shoot her plane down over Taiwan. And you've got the Taliban harboring Al-Qaeda and the Al-Qaeda leader in their country. It's a failure. Any way you look at it, it's a failure. We got more to talk about with the elections. We'll get you a big update. We'll find out where the numbers are recently. Is there still hope in some of these very close races? How soon will they be called? And some of the ins and outs, some of the behind the scenes thing. Great conversation with Chuck Coughlin today from High Ground about where we're going. What will these races look like and what's necessary in these races for either side to win? We're going to do our best to have all of these candidates on as we approach and we get to this general election. I want to make sure we do best we can to inform voters. So we will be doing all of that. But we're going to talk about those next.